Thanks very much. John Anderson's one smart guy. He worked out how not to be here. Extreme measures, I think. Resigning, so. But effective. So I bring you greetings from the People's Republic of Queensland. Anyone else here from Queensland?
Yes.
Okay. Refugees, one and all. Good to see you. Although I've been in Melbourne this morning, it's freezing in Melbourne. I did Channel 7. Where's the Channel 7 crew? Next time you do one of those live crosses from outside Melbourne Airport, can you supply an overcoat? It was focusing of the mind. So Daniel in the Lion's Den, I like that. That's how I feel a little bit this morning on questions like this. I was told that this was Christians in the media, and then there are media monitoring Christians in the media. So feel suitably monitored, all of you. So I got a confession to make, and that is, actually I have many to make, but the particular confession I have to make this morning is that in politics we do feel uncomfortable talking about these things. And the reason is the enormous capacity to be misunderstood, to be misrepresented. And I suppose, therefore, it's important to say from the outset that when people come to gatherings like this and speak as Christians in politics, I say it and I mean it, that I don't stand before you as some sort of paragon of Christian virtue. I'm not. Flawed and as failed as the rest of those who work in politics and the rest of humanity. And the sort of views I'll put to you this morning are very much my own views, and equally flawed and failed, but my best attempt in pursuit of what I understand to be truth. But I think part of the reason why I've decided to begin speaking out on some of these questions is from where we sit in the political spectrum, and with the emergence of the Family First phenomenon at the end of last year, and the emergence of, at that stage at least, a strong political alliance between Family First and the Conservative parties, that many of us concluded on our side of the political divide it was important to speak out with an alternative Christian voice. And that's what I'm seeking to do, but with all the caveats that I've just mentioned. Christianity and politics. Well, there's nothing new under the sun. The essential dilemma remains as it was, I think, in the days of the New Testament. You remember the Great Exchange, where Jesus of Nazareth said to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. Of course, the Nazarene had the good sense not to define what either actually meant. That is, what are those things which uniquely belong to Caesar? What are those things which uniquely belong to God? And therein lies the dilemma which has confounded the engagement between Christians of all persuasions and the political process through the intervening 20 centuries. If you look at the first three centuries of the church's history, essentially the role of the state in relation to the church was one of active persecution, at least within, let's call it the Roman Empire and later the Western Roman Empire. Then you had Constantine's conversion in 312. And then you had a different model whereby the state became the church. The state assumed the church within itself. And that model, by and large, continued through to the Reformation, whereby the state increasingly assumed the responsibilities of the church of the state in terms of military affairs, in terms of diplomacy, in terms of the administration of justice. There was a convergence between the civil and the religious courts. Then you had the Reformation, and whether it was either in its English or in its European manifestations, what you saw then was not an attempt so much to disestablish the church or remove it formally from the state, but a different view of the form of Christianity to be articulated by the state. And when you saw that religious divide reach its crescendo in the Thirty Years' War and the Treaty of Westphalia, which concluded it in 1648, again, you didn't see the disestablishment of the church, that is, the removal of the church from the state. You simply saw the emergence of Protestant Christian princes and Catholic Christian princes. It was really not until the 19th century that you began to see a different view emerge, primarily through the agencies of both the French and the American revolutions. Of course, in the French Revolution, a violent and bloody affair manifests itself in a rabid and radical anti-clericalism and the persecution of the church at that time was acute. In the American Revolution, of course, it took a different form. The revolution was fought essentially between American Puritan colonists, by and large, and their English Anglican overlords. But the political compact which was devised after that was unique, and that is a formal decision by the founding fathers of the United States to separate institutionally and legally the church from the state. And these were the great debates which raged through the 1770s and the 1780s leading up to the determination of the American Constitution. Jefferson was at the middle of that, Thomas Jefferson, and he waged a war against those who wanted to, in the new American Republic, entrench a particular version of Protestant Christianity as the official religion of the United States. Of course, why Jefferson was able to prevail against that view was that there was no unanimity as to which Protestant version of Christianity should be so entrenched. The First Church of the New Truth, the Second Church of the New Truth, the Third Church of the New Truth, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, you name it, everyone had their bid in. So Jefferson prevailed, and I think prevailed enormously sensibly with the view that there shall be no established religion within the United States. And a formal separation ensued. That had a profound influence, of course, on the unfolding of events here. When a century later, our founding fathers set about framing the Australian Constitution in the 1890s, one of the debates was on the question of the establishment of religion. And if you look at the constitutional papers from the time, they are focused on this question of whether a continuing English model, that is, which saw the continued establishment of the Church of England as the established formal religion of the United Kingdom, should be transplanted into Australia, or whether the American Jeffersonian model should be applied, which is the formal separation of church and state. Our founding fathers resolved in the second direction, and I think to the good health of this country's future political and spiritual evolution as well. So what's the point of all that? Simply to say that there is nothing new under the sun. People have been wrestling with this dilemma about the role of Christianity in politics and the formal relationship between the church and the state for the better part of two millennia. And the essential dilemma delivered in the Gospels about rendering unto Caesar that which is Caesar, unto God that which is God's, is no more clearly defined two millennia later than it was in those ancient times. So the question confronting us in contemporary Australia, I suppose, is this. How do people engaged in the political process best resolve that dilemma today? Well, let me run through a range of models which exist. And let me conclude those models with the one with which I feel to be most appropriate. Model number one says, in terms of Christians' involvement in politics, says, vote for me because I'm a Christian. Needless to say, this is the model that I am least attracted to. In fact, I find it repugnant. That simply says that if I profess an external Christianity of some description or another, then X, Y, and Z out there in the community should come rolling in the ballot box, should come rolling in the polling booth and vote for me. I don't see any underpinning theological or scriptural authority behind that view, but it is nonetheless active in the minds of some out there in the political process. Then there is model number two, which is along these lines. Vote for me because A, I'm a Christian, and B, because I have a particular defined set of views on what's classically defined as the life issues, and those relating to sex and sexuality in particular. Shall we say morality as narrowly defined as possible? That's model number two. Model number three says something like this. Take A and B above and then add to it the overgloss of what I would describe as, quote, the tag family values. That is, vote for me, I'm a Christian, I have a defined set of views on, quote, the life issues to doing the sex and sexuality, and over here I chant the mantra of something called family values. Tick the box, vote for me, Bob's your uncle. I'm not enormously attracted to that one either. Model number four, tick one, two, and three above, but add the kicker. And the kicker is unleash a political fusillade against anyone who dares stray beyond that scope by suggesting that Christianity might have something to say about other political, economic, and social questions in life. In other words, a view which says anyone who seeks to articulate from a Christian perspective a view on Iraq, a view on poverty in the world, a view on foreign policy more generally, a view on refugees and asylum seekers, a view on Indigenous Australians, or a view, dare I say it, on workplace relations, then a pox on your houses. And may judgment be rained down upon you from the heavens above. And that's what I would describe in a somewhat partisan note as the gospel according to St. Pete. In the sense that, if you look most recently at what the treasurer, Peter Costello, had to say about my own church head, Philip Aspinall, who's now the primate of Australia and head of the Anglican Church, when he raised some questions about the workplace relations debate, Pete responded by saying he hasn't studied industrial relations, he's only studied theology. And of course, that's code language for saying you cannot have an informed and legitimate Christian view of matters beyond, I'm a Christian, I have a divine set of views on the life issues, and I talk about family values. That's model number four. Model number five is along these lines. It says that when it comes to questions of policy before the political process, that there rarely is an absolutely explicit and defined, authoritative, universally applicable Christian response. But it simultaneously says that there are a set of values which are informed by a Christian belief which should shape your response to the policy debate. Now, what does all that mean when decoded? I think the important principle to note here is, and it goes to the core of this unresolved debate, our democracy in Australia and in all Western countries is inherently a secular democracy. It is a democracy into which are injected a range of different policy views, classically defined as of the left, the right, and the centre, though those tags don't mean a lot anymore, but views which are nonetheless put together in the melting pot of our secular democracy and through a process of representative government distilled through our parliaments to shape the laws of the land. My view is that that is as it should be, and that those who are Christians involved in that process have a responsibility as either individual Christians or as members of the Christian community more broadly or as churches or as Christians in politics to reflect and to articulate their values into that policy debate and to do so without apology. The question is, when other views are put up against that, how do Christians best respond? Sometimes you encounter in the broader Christian community the view that a Christian view should always prevail, no matter what. I respond by saying, that's terrific, but we don't live in a theocracy. We live in a democracy, which is secular. If you want a theocratic form of government, then you're several centuries late. Unless you want to live in various parts of the Middle East right now. But if you want to live in a secular democracy, you are in a contestable political environment where views shall be distilled through the ballot box. And if Christians are of the view that their views are not being reflected sufficiently through the ballot box, then I would suggest that has more to do with the changing shape and architecture of Australian society than it does with the accuracy of the representativeness of the political process. That is, you end up electing the people that the society itself ultimately reflects. If you look at the census data, the number of people who have professed an active belief in God has gone down over time. The most recent census data says that's about 70% in Australia. It's somewhat less than that in Western Europe, somewhat greater than that in the United States. But the trend line in recent times has been in one direction. So the secularity, if you like, of the views reflected into the political process directly express what's happening in the mainstream society. So when I say it is important within a secular democratic process to reflect a Christian values perspective, then it's important to define further what the core components are of that Christian values perspective. There is a danger sometimes in overcomplicating the message and overcomplicating the simplicity of the principles inherent in the New Testament. If you look at the essential core component of the Christian message, it is inherent in the new commandment, that you love your fellow man as you love yourself. And if you look at where that comes from in terms of the prophetic tradition of the Old Testament, then plainly that comes also from a tradition which saw the role of the believer as one, in addition to their belief in God, one which had that belief expressed in a form of care for the weak and the oppressed within society. If you look at the continued tradition of the Old Testament prophets, the greater prophets, the lesser prophets, they constantly talk about caring for the orphan and the widow. They constantly talk about bringing justice to the oppressed. I mean, that is a continuing tradition throughout the prophetic literature. Add to that what we have with the New Testament, New Commandment, and the injunction to love your neighbour as yourself, there is inherent within both those traditions, one old, one new, together a powerful organising set of values which should shape how you respond to the individual practical policy challenges of the day. Can you therefore deduce from that the specific Christian policy response to tax proposal X should be as followed, or environmental proposal Y should be as follows? No. Does it, however, provide you with, as a Christian in politics, with a moral compass within which to engage in that analysis? Yes, it does. That is my best articulation of how Christians in politics should engage the complex array of policy questions before them. If you look at the history of Christianity and politics, I see many of the great figures of Christian history engaged in this process of applying these core Christian precepts to the pressing political challenges of their time. Look at Wesley, the father of modern Methodism. John Wesley. And John Wesley, apart from his profound effect on the revival and the awakening in England in the 18th century, simultaneously had about him a strong social message for the England of that time, which was embraced and articulated through his decision to establish charitable schools. And in London itself, Wesley established a dispensary, the function of which was to provide cheap and affordable medicines for the poor. That was John Wesley. Evangelical Christians know Wesley primarily through theology and hymns. If you're a poor person on the streets of London in the 18th century, you knew of Wesley through charitable schools and the dispensary. Wilberforce, an evangelical who spent 40 years, I should say, in a personal political crusade for the abolition of slavery, the obscenity that was slavery, but an obscenity which had been defended by institutional Christians for some 17 centuries before that. And a powerful mission on his part applied to a classically social question, namely the legitimacy of slavery. Wilberforce prevailed, and the law was changed. Look at Shaftesbury, an evangelical. And the conditions to which he addressed himself was the conditions of were those relating to child labour, particularly in the factories and the mines of the England of the Industrial Revolution. And Shaftesbury ultimately prevailed. We look also at an individual called Keir Hardie, lesser known in this country. Those of us associated with the labour movement know him better. Keir Hardie was an active, committed Scottish Presbyterian. He was also down the mines as a pit worker as a child from the age of 12. He taught himself to read from the Bible. Keir Hardie's view was that I cannot go to Kirk on Sunday and teach Sunday school and be indifferent to the conditions in the pit on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, where 11 and 12-year-old children were being killed by the week in the unsafe industrial conditions of the time. Keir Hardie, who taught himself to read from the Bible, Keir Hardie, a founding member of the Ayrshire Miners Union, subsequently founded the British Labour Party, the government in power in London today. We also look at other great figures in Christian political history. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran, a pastor, an evangelical pastor, confronted with the great challenge of the century, how do you prosecute a personal faith with integrity in the midst of a regime which was embarking upon a genocide against the Jewish people and which was undermining every form of political liberty which existed not just within Germany but the rest of Europe. How did a Lutheran pastor respond to that? Well, a lot of the Lutheran church hold up the white flag. But not Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer's response was, I have a political and social responsibility which proceeds from my faith. What did Bonhoeffer do? He then became the leader of the dissenting church, which he called the confessing church. He came out publicly at the very beginning and publicly campaigned against Hitler's proclamation of the race laws. And then, from 1943 on, participated actively in the plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler, to kill. Pretty active decision on the part of a Lutheran pastor, I would have thought. And he was hanged 2 weeks before the end of the war in a final fitful act of vengeance on the part of the Nazi regime. A man whose 100th anniversary, that is, the anniversary of his birth, we celebrate this year, and my hero in politics. Desmond Tutu, Anglican Archbishop of South Africa, a person who in the midst of the apartheid regime had the courage to say, this is not the way to go. There is an alternative way, that it is inherently wrong for there to be two classes of individuals based on race. And in Latin America, Bishop Romero, his campaign against corruption in the Latin American regime in the country where he had his mission. What of Australia today? Well, I mentioned before Keir Hardie. Keir Hardie was the founder of the British Labour Party. In the Ayrshire Miners Union was another bloke working whose name was Andrew Fisher. Andrew Fisher subsequently came to this country. And Andrew Fisher was elected to the Queensland Parliament in the 1890s, was elected to the Commonwealth Parliament in 1901, and in 1907 as a practicing Christian socialist, and that was in the tradition of Keir Hardie, became the first majority Labour Prime Minister of Australia in 1907. And Andrew Fisher, in his life and in his commitment to reforms concerning the age pension, concerning a workers' compensation, concerning how you looked after people when they run into the great brick walls of life, showed every bit the same type of commitment that we saw earlier in Keir Hardie's life. The movement from which the likes of Keir Hardie and Andrew Fisher come is called the Christian Socialist Movement. It exists today. It's called CSM or CSU, the Christian Socialist Union. It has its headquarters in London. It has its own secretariat. Of the British Labour Party today, some 350 members of the House of Commons are members of the British Labour Party. They have some 105, 110 members of the British Parliamentary Labour Party who are active members of the Christian Socialist Union. They meet on a weekly or a monthly basis. I met them recently in London. Interestingly, the current General Secretary of the Christian Socialist Union is a woman who comes from one of the strongest and best known British Pentecostal churches. Here in Australia, since the war, we've also had leading clerics, some of whom you may not have heard of, others more familiar to you. One that I'm more familiar with is called Bishop Ernest Henry Bergman. Bishop Bergman was the Bishop of Canberra and Goulburn through much of the 30s, 40s and 50s. Robert Menzies described him as the Red Bishop. And that's because Bishop Bergman, or Bergie as he was called, had a different view of politics to a classic conservative coalition view of politics, namely that the first responsibility of the state was to provide for the poor, the weak and the oppressed. I attended Bergman College at the Australian National University. That's where I first came in contact with some of Bergman's writings. So the reason for running through that is to explain that the tradition of Christianity and politics that I come from is one which doesn't see a personalised health and wealth gospel as the beginning and the end of it. Our view is that there is also added social responsibilities which flow from an individual Christian faith. Remember, this Jesus who said in the New Testament, "You must be born again," is the same Jesus who says in the New Testament, "You must clothe the naked and feed the hungry." There is a great temptation in our renditions of Christianity to compartmentalise the message, that is, the bits which suit us as opposed to the bits which don't. I think the message there is broad and clear. And when we are spoken to through the pages of the New Testament, more broadly through the Scriptures, about the continuing social responsibility of Christians, I do not see that as simply being constrained to individual, random philanthropic acts. And what do I mean by that? Many churches that you may be associated with here engage in necessary, useful, and effective charitable work. And it's fantastic that they do so. And I see in many of the communities that I'm associated with in Brisbane, churches strongly engage in their local communities in employment, whether it's in counselling, whether it's in providing assistance to people who are thrown out on the street, people who actually need bread on the table that night, otherwise there is nothing to eat. I see that, and it is moving to see it at work and those who actually take that Christian message out into the streets. But at the end of the day, when you look at the totality of this country's needs and you look at the totality of the world's needs, random individual philanthropic acts, either by individuals or organisations, don't cover the field. There are enormous gaps. That is where our tradition, a Christian socialist tradition, comes from. We actually said 100 years ago, there is a responsibility for the state to provide an overarching safety net to catch people who find themselves in life's difficult situations. There is a separate debate about how the safety net should be constructed and the conditionalities attached to it. But our view is that you cannot simply say, when it comes to charity and or charitable responsibility or social responsibility coming out of Christian belief, that that is only executed through what I as an individual do or I through my local church or community organisation do. We have a view that in order to cover the field, in order to ensure that the gaps are removed to the greatest extent possible, that there is an important comprehensive role for the community through government in the construction of a humane safety net. And in the great tradition of Wesley, our view also is that this view of our social responsibility doesn't stop at the continental shelf. Wesley's great dictum, remember, was, in answer to a question, "The world is my parish." Wesley did not say this part of Southeast England is my parish. He didn't say that this part of the hills in Sydney is my parish. Wesley said, consistent with the universalist message which is contained within these pages, the world is my parish. Similarly, in terms of our concept of providing a humane and human safety net for our collective humanity, that the poverty which is in Southern Africa at the moment, the fact that we have 1.2 billion people across the world today who live below $2 a day, the current World Bank-defined level of poverty, is equally our collective social responsibility. And we can say again, well, we've got fantastic individual charitable organisations engaged in dealing with that problem. We have World Vision. We have Caritas through the Catholic Church. We have Anglican Aid Abroad. We have many, many church charitable organisations working across the world. And I've met many of them in the field. And they fill your heart with gladness when you run into them because they're doing such fantastic things. But can they cover the field as well? No, they can't. That's why we have international agencies of government, albeit imperfectly through the United Nations and through the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, and through UNICEF, whose job it is to assist in constructing a universal safety net which can catch people who would otherwise fall through and end up in impossible circumstances through disease and death. That is the tradition that I come from. Of course, applied to Australia's current circumstances, there is the immediate practical challenge of how should we all respond to one of the great debates of our current political agenda, and that's workplace relations. I suppose where we come from on that question is this. We do not see human beings as simply equaling any other commodity which can be traded on a market like any other commodity. Human beings, in our view, have an inherent dignity, and from a Christian point of view, the product of the Creator. Therefore, they cannot simply be regarded as a piece of property out there, a piece of land, or a bunch of coal, or whatever else. Humans require particular protections. And the critical question then is, how do you provide those protections given the complexity of any country's industrial relations system? So the questions for us are, how do you fairly provide or justly provide for the establishment of a minimum wage? How should that be done and by whom? Should we end up with a situation whereby 15-year-olds working at Baker's Delight are left in a position where they have to negotiate one-on-one with a very experienced employer without the protection of any underlying award? Is that fair and just to put an individual 15-year-old in that situation? We would say no. Is it fair to have a system which enables you to be sacked and removed from your place of employment without just cause and without reason? Or is it better to have and fairer to have some system of unfair dismissal laws? And how do you provide all of the above in a way which still recognises the need for firms to compete in the international marketplace, a difficult, globally competitive marketplace? All we would say is that when you look at the proposals currently on offer from the Prime Minister on this question, that we don't think the balance has got right. We think the balance is being pushed too far. We also argue that even the economic case being advanced in support of this level of workplace relations reform has not been made. If the concern is to boost productivity, because productivity growth is faltering in Australia, what then of the role of education, training and skills formation, human capital development? What then of the role of research and development? What then of the role of infrastructure? What then of the role of some of the dysfunctional aspects of our structure of government, including the Federation? What's the role of all these things in terms of productivity in the economy? And why should the total productivity burden be placed on employees? That's the economic case, but then there's the moral case as well, which is this fair? And does it actually represent justice in the workplace? That is where we come from on this question. And that's why you see right across Australia at the moment some of the mainstream churches exhibiting a high degree of anxiety about the proposals on offer. I mentioned before the Anglican primate, Archbishop Aspinall, he's raised some concerns. Cardinal Pell has raised concerns. Archbishop Jensen, I believe, has raised some concerns. The Uniting Church has done so. The National Council of Churches has done so. Senator Stephen Fielding from Family First has raised concerns. I simply say to you this, why are these concerns all being raised? Because I think on the part of many reasonable Christians, this is causing deep qualms of conscience as to whether this is the right way to go. And that is why I think you see the churches speaking out. And of course, when you look at Catholic social teaching in these areas and the history of the papal encyclicals on the proper protection of labour rights, this goes back to 1890 in the Pope's great encyclical called Rerum Novarum on basic social reform and social justice, the centennial document following that called Centesimus Annus in 1991, and a specific papal encyclical dealing with the rights of labour written in 1981 called Laborum Exercens. All of these papal documents deal with the rights of labour as proceeding from a view of labour which says it has an intrinsic dignity and that labour is not simply some other commodity to be traded. That is where we come from on this question. To conclude, could I simply say this, as I've now lost the last page of my speech. I actually did this on the plane this morning, a few notes. The question rightly posed in a forum of this nature is, what then constitutes the role of Christians in the media in dealing with not just the debate on workplace relations, but more broadly, the challenges we face in ensuring that the democracy, which is secular, that we have, is being properly and fairly reported through the pages of our media and through and broadcast through our electronic media as well. So we now move to the inspirational part of my address, because I've lost that page altogether. That's good, because this is all you. You're Christians in the media. I think it goes along these lines. First principle, you are part and parcel of the political process, whether you like it or not. Because when it comes to the exercise of political power in this country and every other Western democracy that I have had anything to do with, the media, year by year, decade by decade, exercises greater power, not lesser power. How is that power articulated? One, you decide what constitutes the news. Two, you decide what page it goes on or how high up the bulletin it goes. Three, you decide what slant goes on the story. Four, you decide whether the picture of Rudd is a terrible picture, a half-reasonable picture, or a happy smiley picture. And a picture tells 1,000 words. Four, you ultimately are the arbiters of balance within the story. And is the opposition view or the government view given prominence or not? And if the opposition view is reflected, does it constitute the mandatory one par at the end of it of a 28-par piece whereby the opposition is quoted as saying, I exist? Or is it reflected by some other means which says, actually, there's an alternative way of looking at this, which is A, B, C, and D. And I've got to say, with the best political skillcraft in the world, it's very hard to condense that message into a single sentence. You need at least a few paragraphs to do it. So what am I saying to you through all of this? It's to say that you, the media, exercise political power. And you may not like to publicly admit the fact, but you do. So the question is, how do you exercise it? Using what principles do you seek to exercise it? And as someone who's not a journalist, I only speak as someone on the outside of the process, but here are some random observations. If you have about you a view that, first and foremost, you're in the business of the pursuit of truth, that ain't a bad starting point. If you have about you a view which says that objectivity, rather than being told to do what by your editors or chiefs of staff is the way to go, that ain't a bad attitude to have. When it comes to the question of balance, and even if you disagree with it, that the opposing point of view has a legitimate place in the presentation of the story, that ain't a bad attitude to have. When it comes to your view of society at large, having compassion for the weak and the voiceless ain't a bad attitude to have. And when you put all those things together, also being very wary of being seduced by those in political authority with the ultimate hook of the exclusive, which is, here's a yarn for you, mate, and you will do the right thing by us, won't you, mate? Okay? Now, no side of politics is immune from that particular form of political behaviour. But you are those who decide whether it's going to work or not, and whether it's going to be successfully applied to you and the news outlets that you work for. These, I think, are very important attributes to have about you. And I conclude on this. It is doubly important in Australia and at this time in our country's political history that you exercise that independent role. Why do I say that? As of 1 July, for the first time in 25 years, the government has the control of the Senate and therefore the entire Parliament. We now no longer know whether there will be properly functioning Senate estimates committees in the future. That is, the Senate exercising its normal inquisitorial functions. We don't know beyond estimates whether Senate committees will be allowed to be established in areas which are uncomfortable for the government. And this is new in the course of the history of this country over the last quarter of a century. And looking at the faces of some of you around the room and the ages which those faces suggest, some of you weren't around a quarter of a century ago to know what it was like. Furthermore, the great institutions of this country which also exercise constraints on the abuse of executive power, the Australian Public Service, I regret to say, in recent times has increasingly become compromised in terms of its fearless independence. If you doubt what I say on that, go to the parliamentary inquiries into the way in which pre-war intelligence was handled on Iraq. On the question of the independence of the Australian Defence Force, if you have doubts of independence on that question, and I have great respect for our men and women in uniform, but I look at the outcome of inquiries into the role played by our military in the Children Overboard saga, and I think it's bad for governments to put the military in that position, but it's bad also for some of our senior military leaders not to have said no. I look at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I think you've had Donald MacDonald here today. Within the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, what do I see? Over time, a contraction of space given to current affairs and news. I see that across commercial news outlets more generally. And I find that in the programs that I have dealings with, that there is less space over time given to opposition or alternate points of view. Therefore, putting all these factors together, I would say that the role and the importance of an independent voice within journalism, shaped by the sorts of values that I sought to describe before, is now in our country's political life more important than ever. All power to your arm. Thank you.